Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
I am absolutely honoured and privileged, as the only words I can think of. I'm honoured to be speaking and to bring to you Dr. Matt Shelton, someone who has not only gone the extra mile, not only has he handed the extra coat in service to New Zealand, but someone who I admire immensely. I've heard him on stage. We had a brief conversation once when he came down to Queenstown. My part of the world is Wanaka, as many of you know. And in case you're wondering what the hell this is that you're listening to, this is Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair with Jerry Pive. So Dr. Matt Shelton, are we even allowed to call you doctor anymore?
Oh, hell yes. But look, with that intro, I'm only going to disappoint, of course. But look, it's lovely to see you again, Jerry, and I do remember meeting you. And yes, I am still a doctor. I'm on the medical register. I don't have a practicing certificate at the moment. There'll be innumerable obstacles to getting one, and I recognise that. So I've been very busy just doing non-clinical work. But my hard-earned medical degree will be with me till I die, so please do.
Well, Matt, it's a real pleasure to talk with you, and I'm sure many of the listeners will be as excited as I am to find out a little bit about the man behind the warrior, because I think of you as a warrior, I have to say, and I've seen you in so many different settings and doing so many important things. And every time I've come across you, all I've ever felt, something you've done, something, a petition into Parliament, a talk on the streets, a talk on the stage, every time one of several people who are the backbone of New Zealand doctors speaking out with science, I'm just going to say that one more time, speaking out with science, every time I've seen you or been around you or heard of what you've done, all I've felt, deeply, deeply felt, Matt, is gratitude. And I want to express that to you. I just want to say that to you on a personal note. Thank you, bloody thank you, all right? I want to say that to you. Thank you for all you've sacrificed and all you've done to do what you do. It touches me, and you speak for me, and I think you speak for thousands of people across New Zealand. So thank you. I'm going to embarrass you, aren't I?
Oh, gold. Well, thank you, Jerry. Look, I hate every minute of this. I'm an introvert. I just want to, be tucked away in my little consultation room, having just one-on-one conversations and trying to help people as best I can with what I've picked up over the years. But, despite that, I guess it's been the easiest thing I've ever done in terms of the decisions to just go ahead and try and shout some warnings and things. And as the consequences, well, they'll just roll out as they're going to. And it's not something I try to think about. We're eating a bit more cheaply. I've lost a little bit of weight. So that's all good. But, the bigger picture is too important to worry, I suppose, about my own personal circumstances. And that's the thing I struggle with all this, actually, is having to have a profile. And, every time I do an interview, I just, my heart sinks afterwards. And I think, oh, God, what have I done now? But then I remember what I'm trying to do, at least, and hopefully it'll make a difference. And there are plenty of other people, anyway, who are doing the same sort of thing. And if enough of us make enough of a noise, we can maybe enable everybody to kind of recognize what we've got to reclaim. And we're only going to do it by being active and proactive and noisy.
Truth does need speaking for, doesn't it?
Oh, of course it does. I have a similar pathway to you, actually. And it touches on a really important point that I was hoping I was going to be able to make today. And we're here a bit earlier than I thought, I guess. And that is the time that it takes to kind of form our views and the evolution in thinking and just personal development that we all go through. And what it takes to get us to a place where you and I are now, where, it couldn't be clearer what's wrong, what the problems are, where they come from, and maybe even who's behind it all. But we're expecting the majority of people who thankfully for them, haven't necessarily had to inquire into the darker side of human nature and human history, which of course just reflects each other perfectly. But it does take a long time. And similarly, I've probably been at it about 20 years, I guess, since I finally recognized that the drug paradigm was no way enough to help people recover their health and understand the causes of illness and things. And so we start looking around for other, you know, other arrows in the quiver that we can kind of bring to bear in trying to help people. But that is a, you know, an evolutionary process. You might have a road to Damascus experience where you suddenly understand what you've got to learn and where else you've got to look. Even something as simple as getting people to start, you know, looking at the quality of the food they eat as a way forward can bring up so much so quickly for people, especially all the barriers to doing that. You know, one of which has always been self-esteem, the idea that, well, am I actually worth the trouble? What's stopping me from improving my diet or looking at the foods I choose differently, you know, as the building blocks for my body? And of course, the body is the temple for the soul. So it's where I live. So you might as well make the best choices you can so you can kind of last the distance and you know, have a happy life if you can. But, you know, the drug paradigm itself, it's not bankrupt. You know, there are some amazing developments and gifts really that have come out of science, but actually so much of it's a load of crap. And navigating that and acknowledging that all this time and effort you've put into sort of learning to use very powerful and very toxic chemicals as safely as it's possible to is actually just a fraction of what healing's about and what else there is to learn outside of that. And certainly us in NZDSOS, you know, most of the doctors that form the thing at the start had already been through that journey. We were pretty much all integrative medicine practitioners. So, you know, it wasn't just that we loved herbs or we you know, gone off and done a weekend course on acupuncture or something like that. It's that actually we recognized, you know, how limiting and actually potentially deadly or dangerous, at least anyway, in the wrong hands, a lot of what we've been taught at medical school actually was in the sort of the broader kind of primary care general practice perspective. But I mean, you know, if you're hit by a bus, you need a skilled and compassionate surgical team and you need high-tech medicine, etc. You know, we're not checking the baby out with the bathwater, but certainly the founding group of NZDSOS had already kind of done this evolutionary journey to a point of being suspicious and seeing the red flags and, you know, really being hot onto the problems right from the start.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, this brings us on to one of the issues that concerns me and many people, and I think many of the listeners to RCR, which is, you know, we want as many people as possible to, as it were, be able to see the bigger picture rather than just the narrow narrative that has been provided by, you know, mainstream medicine, by mainstream media, by mainstream politics, mainstream anything. And in my book, we have to be very, very gentle, I think, because it's almost like waking someone up who's sleepwalking. We don't confront them suddenly. We have to walk along beside them and gently guide them away from the... You know, imagine someone sleepwalking at night and they don't know where they are. They're in an internal sort of headspeak that they don't actually realize they're walking down the hallway towards the stairs. So rather than shock them into awake, we have to gently walk beside them, grab their arm and gently guide them around. And there's a slow turnaround. And if you've ever done that, and I have actually with a couple of people, family members, it takes a while. And it's a gentle awakening. And if we confront them, it's like it's a horror. It's a horror for them. And I think we have to walk very gently, psychologically anyway. We have to accept that our own journeys maybe took a long time. And there were shocks along the way for all of us, I think. There were moments, at least there were for me, of absolute horror and despair at what I was uncovering. But I think we need to go gently, don't you?
Oh, look, I couldn't agree more. And yet, you know, here we are in this situation of literal life and death. You know, and there is an urgent imperative to stop this thing, if we can. And you and I both know what we're talking about here. And I think many of the listeners will as well. But, you know, that's the tension. It's not an ideal world. We don't have a sort of long-term, the luxury of a therapeutic relationship, you know, stretching ahead until the, you know, the money or the interest wears out or people are fine off on their own. You know, there's an urgent imperative. These products are being given to six-month-old babies and up long, long, long after, by any definition, we've all shown that they're toxic and that the whole thing stinks to high heaven and did right from the beginning. And yet, as you say, you risk people's barriers coming down as they defend themselves from, you know, shocking information or stuff that sounds to them so left field, that they wouldn't know what to do with it.
I think so many listeners will be grappling with this internal tension that has literally erupted out of our conversation, because I think it matters to both of us. This evolutionary idea that it takes time, and my sleepwalking analogy, and then thank you for presenting the urgency of this, because that's the other tension, isn't it? You know, right as we're speaking, we know that the WHO is trying to make a land grab for all controlling all governments around the planet to declare God knows how many vaccines that Bill Gates wants us to be having. I think one a minute by the sound of it, you know, and the insanity of what is going around. There is an urgency because people are being hurt, right? So that's a real tension, isn't it?
It is. And it's where the practitioner has that wind in the sails to see, you know, a clear and present danger. And it's what we've always done. And sometimes in many areas of medicine and therapy, you actually have to move quickly. You can see that somebody's really in trouble and you have to move fast. And we kind of recognize that. But it's on such a large scale. You know, it's no longer about us working just with individuals, which you and I have done our whole careers. It's actually for the species and for the planet. And people talk a lot about this, oh, this is a sort of being a spiritual war. I don't know where I am with that, because I think that gives a lot of people an out. You know, if they don't have a particular sort of spiritual bent, or yet they haven't sort of investigated that sort of journey. I think it gives people an opportunity to stay in the armchair and let the spiritual warriors battle it out. But, you know, you're actually batting it out against jackboots and bullets potentially. So it takes more than a few, you know, a bit of chanting and praise to heaven, I think. I think it is a moral battle, and I think that's different. And I think, you know, we all of us, there's an imperative for those of us that understand, as you say, the grab for humanity that's taking place. And this battle, I think, is, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years in the making. In fact, it's hundreds of thousands of years in the making, because we've come so far, so fast, as a sort of technological society, but scratch beneath the surface. And we're all still cave people scrabbling around, running on instinct and trying to survive as best we can. And recent human history, the few thousand years that we've got recorded history anyway, is just a reflection of that. And things are no different now. And this is why so many people were nudged so effectively, because, you know, you push the right buttons and people will do anything they can to survive. But the particular fear that you feed them will determine what they do. I think we all see the propaganda and the sort of the mass psychological manipulation that's gone on, because we're trained in it and we, you know, we've spotted it early on. But the challenge is reaching, isn't it, the majority of people who, you know, have had such a number done on them that it's almost like having to rescue them from a cult. But how do you do that? You do that individually, and then you have to spend a lot of time and trouble, you know, bringing people out and reprogramming them. And we don't have the time to do that to everybody as individuals. But what I've always admired about the Voices for Freedom approach, and LCR as well, is this notion of having courageous conversations, as many as possible and as quickly as possible, and then teaching other people to do the same thing, so that we can get this sort of networking, exponential kind of movement of understanding that actually the things that we were frightened of or told to be frightened of are actually very different from the things we should be frightened of. And in fact, if we all act together, there's actually nothing to be frightened of, because it's such a small number of sort of people, I guess, that we're up against. But the power that they can wield and the money they have, it's going to take a lot of pushback. But I think we'll get there, and I couldn't be happier to have seen RCR formed and join the fray, because we just need voices in the space that up to now has been dominated by the very well-funded establishment.
How do we find out the truth? And what is the truth? Because fundamentally, I live in a world where there is truth, and there is the opposite of truth, which is deceit, lies, propaganda, manipulation, all those words.
Look, we don't necessarily need to know for certain what all the truths are, but we've got to start by recognizing when we're being lied to. As you said very well, there's the truth and then there's the opposite of the truth. And when you see people being censored, bullied, shut down, ignored, and when you see a vast amounts of evidence, good quality science that's also being ignored, that is very suspicious. And it should really get people's radar ticking away. There's a sort of maxim, isn't there, that, you know, governments don't just not do the right thing. They do the opposite of the right thing often. And, you know, we are seeing the opposite of the right things being done to people, irrespective of what the science said. You know, when was it ever, ever right to experiment on children, pregnant women, people that aren't at risk of a particular problem? It's actually hard to get your head around the bulldozing of the norms that has occurred in the last few years in the name of fighting this virus, if it is one. And certainly it's pretty clear that it was engineered in the first place. And of course, so was the response. But where's the precedent? There isn't one. Well, there are actually, you can drag a few out. And as a good example, again, of the sort of the cognitive distress that when you're looking at evidence that actually goes back decades, for instance, in the case of fluoridation of the water, which most of the world doesn't do anymore. But here in, you know, Hermit King, New Zealand, it's still being put about that it's a slam dunk, positive for all of the community, and that there's no downsides. And nothing could be further from the truth. There is stacks of proof that it damages the brain. And yet it's still being argued in court, whether it's the right thing to do. But more importantly, whether the assessment of our Bill of Rights, the rights that we have and the protections, is still relevant in the modern age. And we're taking a challenge with Fluoride Free New Zealand to essentially get a declaration on exactly that. You know, do we as individuals still matter? And do our rights matter? Are they important? Or have they been tossed aside, you know, in the drive to this brave new world of the wonders of biotech and the leaders of the collective being far more important than any of the individuals? Well, absolutely, we're still important. And this is what we have to sort of all stand together and fight for, whatever we think about the science, actually. And that's the beauty of the philosophy of what it means to be human, is in the end, you don't even have to argue the science. Because, you know, if we all agree, we have a right to life, we have a right to speak our mind, we have a right to pursue our profession, you know, and we have all these other rights to travel freely and to have clean air and clean water and good food, then really we're home and hosed. But let's start having those conversations and maybe make it not about the science if people can't go there at this stage. That's where I think the worst harms are being done. And where the fight is probably the easiest at the moment to kind of carry out is those discussions.
And this brings us back to the moral war that you're talking about, a battle of morality or conflicting moralities. One morality that says we've got the power and we can decide, and another that says every human life is precious and has equal rights.
Yeah, it's very binary, isn't it? You can't have them both. And I know which side I'm on and you are. And, you know, most right-thinking people ought to agree that without a sort of basic moral framework, a kind of code of behavior, then we're back in the jungles and it's dog eat dog. And there are people who are making these decisions for us who probably fairly coldly and callously believe on the inside that we've never actually left and it is still dog eat dog. And if we're stupid enough to be led down a very dark pathway, well, that's our problem. And it serves us right. But it's this fifth generation idea where you don't even know you're in a war, you don't know who the enemy is, and you certainly don't know the weapons that are being used. And I think from a New Zealand context, we're coming of age now because we have actually been invaded. We just didn't see it coming. And I think this is the time where we actually have a choice to make.
How do you keep going when the going gets tough?
There's actually a lot of us now, and certainly I'm part of a group that, you know, we all get stuck in. We're all individuals and we all do our own individual thing. But the hard thing is talking about, you know, the reality of what's going on, what's being done to people individually and us as a species. And I find it hard to talk about without feeling very emotional because it really matters. And it does then actually make it a bit harder to articulate and get your thoughts across. But that's, you know, I try and forgive myself for that because I'm human. And being more of an introvert, I guess, certainly downtime, you know, alone time, and, you know, creative pursuits have always been very important for me. So I'm a musician as well, professional musician, as well as a doctor. I mean, that's kind of my other day job, I guess, at the moment. You know, so having a sort of creative outlet, I think, is very important for people. So hobbies and being able to do the music certainly is important for me, and it keeps me sane. But, you know, I'm part of a group that is madly, you know, we're accused occasionally as of just getting together and confirming all our own biases, but there's well over 200 doctors now in our group. So that's a big group that allows us to kind of peer review what we think is going on and each other. And so I'm up in front of the health tribunal next year. You know, I'm still not quite sure what the charges are, but essentially it's going to be that, you know, I can't easily tell the difference between what's real and what isn't in terms of medical evidence, but they're probably trying to make out I'm mental as well, is that I lack discrimination and lack the ability to be able to tell what's good quality science and what isn't. But I certainly know propaganda and consensus-driven medicine by committee that we're being subjected to. And I know the power of groups to censor individuals and just the power of the herd, essentially, to maintain the same narrative, because it's more important that they're sort of emotionally comfortable and safe than actually they discover what the truth is. And that's just human nature. And it's true of many groups. And there is this streak that goes through humanity, and it's always been there, of, you know, people who just lack any sensitivity to the suffering of others. They're immune to pain. Once we've come out of this, and we've kind of regained, you know, we've won the battle for humanity, it's only going to happen again down the line. You know, so what is it that causes, you know, psychopathy, or however you want to think about it? When you look back, most people who've lived have had a fairly unpleasant and frightening life. You know, and there've been a few brief periods in human history where the sun's come out and thought has allowed to flourish and movements have taken hold. But then suddenly somebody else has got another idea, and then we're back in the dark ages again. The history of 20th century is the history of murder by governments of its own people. I think, what, between 100 and 200 million people were murdered by their own governments in the country where they lived on ideological grounds. And these are the things that certainly vex me, and I spend a lot of time thinking about. So I then need to antidote by buggering off and playing my music, or, you know, turning the stereo really loud, and hanging out with people, including my family, of course, who largely think like I do. And that's very important. And I love freedom get-togethers because, you know, we all know each other even before we've met. You know, we have skills in observing what's going on, and we've kind of all come quite a long way through our lives, sort of the critical thinking points, or the point where you have a radar, or you've long ago sort of dropped this notion that all people are wonderful and that they're all going to be on our side until proved otherwise. Well, that just ain't the truth. So, you know, we're a big family having pulled around the wagons, but we're not big enough, I don't think, as we are at the moment, to defeat this thing.
Tell me a little bit more about your creative pursuits. Tell me what you get up to when you're not doctoring or working for, you know, doing all your great work with the freedom movement and trying to challenge the damage that is being mainstreamed, really, as if it's normal to kind of murder and kill and hurt people. When you're not doing all that, when you're not standing on stage next to, you know, and with other people, good people, I know you're not alone in this battle, but tell me, when Matt Shelton needs to recover a little bit, what does he do? When the introvert needs to, as it were, soothe himself, what does he do and how does he do it? Because you said you're doing something else as well. You said you're doing professional music. Is that right? I want to hear about that.
Yeah, oh, I've been an orchestral trombonist for the second half of my life.
Can you tell us what the name of the orchestra is?
Well, I'm in Orchestra Wellington here in Wellington, which is the sort of the other orchestra. Wellington's the home of New Zealand Symphony, but they do a lot of touring. And that really is a sort of a top tier, you know, it's the Premier League orchestra. It's full-time, and we are not full-time in Orchestra Wellington, but we definitely punch above our weight, and we're a great collection of people. We have a lot of
wonderful
fun. I never really wanted to be a doctor. My mum did a great job, I think, of conditioning me right from the word go to assume that was my only career choice. And I tried very hard not to get into medical school, but I sort of scraped in, really. But just before that, some of my friends were going off to music college. I played in youth orchestras and things with them. And I'd already fallen in love with the feeling of being in the middle of a symphony orchestra going full tilt. And, you know, the thing about the bigger brass instruments, too, is that you're shoveling huge amounts of air, and it's very physically exhilarating, too. You're not just part of an amazing sound. You know, you're making a lot of that sound yourself. But to be able to do it in a controlled way and still have fun is the challenge, I guess. And I thought I'd learned how to concentrate and focus in my medical career. But when I got my first job in a professional orchestra, which was actually down in Christchurch, actually, I realized I had no idea what true focus, that kind of meditative getting in the zone, actually meant. And it took me a few years to master that, actually. But there is no place like it. And I think when I listen to the greatest of humanity's compositions, it just brings forth these giants of people, all the classical composers, but some of the contemporary ones as well, who somehow seem to just channel this incredible music. And it stands the test of time. And we still, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years later, you know, agree that you know, your Bach and your Beethoven and Tchaikovsky and all these other people have moved us somewhere that we needed to get. And they did it by themselves. I mean, you know, Beethoven was stone deaf for much of his career. He couldn't hear a damn thing. And yet he produced this most amazing music. How do you do that? Where does it come from? And so being a channel for wherever this comes from is just very, very exciting. I mean, I can't improvise to save my life. I never did the woodshedding and put the work in, but I'm happy, you know, to play other people's stuff. So being in an orchestra to me is therapy. It's exacting. And sometimes you're on the edge of your seat. If you stuff up in a gig, there's nowhere to hide once that wrong note's out. But that's a challenge too. You know, you just maintain your focus and you carry on. I think that what I've had to learn, because I never did formal musical training at all, pretty much self-taught. And I've had a few really, really helpful people along the way. And I find myself in this very privileged position, being able to play at a you know, decent level and get paid for it too. And I don't think I could do the rest of it without an outlet. For me, there are a few feelings like going full tilt. The reward comes from two places. You know, you're feeling incredibly excited and thinking, God, this is just so awesome. It sounds amazing. But at the same time, you know, you've got this laser focus on what you're having to do yourself. You know, you're part of something that's much, much bigger. There's a conductor flinging his arms about at the front. But again, the music's actually coming off the page and it's coming out of our instruments. So it's that sort of dichotomy, and it's keeping a lid on the excitement until it's all over. I sort of seem to split my brain into two halves, and there's the bit that's focusing really, really hard. Especially if you're the only one on your part, you know, you haven't got sort of 6, 8, 10 other people all playing exactly the same note that you have. There is nowhere to hide if you make a mistake. But the, you know, the upside is you get your awesome bits where it's very clear that it's you making that particular bit. So there's a huge show-off side of it. And I, you know, I do think probably this is the private introspective little me actually, you know, laying my hair out and saying, you know, look at me, look at me. But you have to produce the goods. You're being paid for it too, and you're expected to get it right. You know, but there's a high that can last for hours and hours, and occasionally days after a really big gig. You're just feeling uplifted and just happy and excited. You know, you're just saturated in this music. You know, my earliest memories were listening to my mum, who was a concert pianist, you know, thundering out music. You know, she still practiced for several hours a day when I was growing up. I think I just sort of saturated it from an early age. So I can't imagine my life without music in some form or another.
Tell us more about growing up. Your mother was a concert pianist, is that right?
Well, that's how she trained. You see, she wanted to be a doctor when she was small, actually. I mean, there's bitter irony in all this, of course. But girls just didn't do science. And her father had her playing on the piano for his friends from the age of about 5. So she went to music college. But she developed very nasty migraines as a sort of young adult. And that kiboshed any sort of professional career because they were, you know, they were monthly and very predictable. And for 3 or 4 days, she was just in terrible pain and really not able to do anything but lie around. So she went into teaching, but she always kept her practicing up. So, you know, she tried to teach me the piano, and of course I was dreadful because I never imagined in my wildest dreams that I would ever be able to be as good as the playing that I'd heard growing up. So I didn't sort of try, but when I was a bit older, she never really had much money, but she managed to take us to Gilbert and Sullivan and stuff when the English National Opera came to town. So I grew up in Oxford in England. And I remember one time she took us to see this Richard Strauss opera called Elektra. And all I remembered was that there were two women who seemed to scream at the top of their lungs for 3 hours. But every time these guys at the back with these sort of long slidey instruments picked up the instruments and played, you know, this amazing sound came out. And I thought, I want to play that. So she started me off, which was actually not great because I got into really bad habits that took me half my life to unpick. And I remember having a professional lesson in Auckland with a guy, really nice bloke. And he said to me, look, I don't know how somebody who plays as badly as you do actually makes a good sound. So, you know, I unpicked a lot of the bad habits I got into. And what's fascinated me, because there's a parallel with my journey in medicine. In my early career, I did anesthetics and intensive care for a few years. So I've always been interested in breathing. The zen of getting a great sound out of a wind instrument, which you shove in your gob and blow the thing, whether it's brass or woodwind, actually is not about what's happening at the lips of the mouthpiece. It's all about the breathing and the blowing. And being able to blow out is actually all about being able to breathe in properly first. As you will know through your sort of psychotherapy and things as well, you know, breathing patterns can vary hugely with our emotional state. And sometimes you can kind of reverse engineer improvements in how we're feeling through actually focusing on the breath and breathing. You know, we know that through meditation, of course. So I really had to learn to breathe in properly, essentially. That was the kind of the corner I turned with my own playing. And it's so simple and it sounds so silly. And yet, you know, there are so many ways you can do it wrong without realizing it. But I never did any training. And that's really how I ended up in medical school, just because that was the other option. And I tried to not get good enough A-levels, and I succeeded actually the first time around. And then my poor mother spent a fair amount of money making me do them all again. And I did even less work the second time, but because the teaching was so good in this sort of cramming college, I actually got just about good enough grades to get into med school. So look, I mean, it wasn't just my mum who, you know, single-mindedly pushed me kicking and screaming into medicine. I actually liked hospitals. I'd spent a bit of time in my childhood in another hospital. I had various operations on my feet, which were shaped like bananas when I was born. And I actually loved hospital because, you know, you were looked after. And, you know, as a kid, they took good care of you. And I just remember being really fascinated by everything. I hated the lying awake the night after each operation, vomiting all night because, you know, I was very, well, not allergic, but had that vomiting side effect with morphine, which is what they would have used for painkillers. So, I never became a junkie. Because I just could never stomach the stuff. So I didn't like that. But, I just liked the novelty and being, you know, being the center of attention, I guess, and being taken care of a bit. So, you know, I didn't mind hospitals. And so I wasn't afraid of what it might be like working in a hospital environment. And then I sadly had to spend a bit of time in hospital later on. My sister got sick and she died in the end. But she spent a lot of time in the hospital before she died. And, you know, that experience, I suppose, is probably what, you know, why I'm where I am now, because to see what happens to a family from the inside when you lose a child is a known quantity. And of course, my professional work, you know, you're seeing this frequently as well. But, you know, there's probably no worse journey for a patient to go through, for a person to go through, a parent to go through, than to lose a child. And to look at what's happening right now, you know, I'm often criticizes me the guy that won't stop talking about dying kids, but somebody's got to talk about it. And it's an absolute obscenity that this is happening. There's a willful blindness to sudden unexpected deaths, you know, that died suddenly in younger people and children compared to what we ever saw. And make no doubt, this is not normal. It's about as far from normal as you can possibly get. We have to stop this. We have to do whatever we can to stop more people going down this pathway. And it's happening in every country, not just ours. So there's a mass outbreak of negligence, dereliction, willful blindness, whatever, however you want to think about it. There's a whole bunch of dead young people at the end of this. So I feel this particularly because it was the end of my mum. Basically, she disappeared into a very, very dark, depressive place for about 10 years. And when she emerged, she disappeared into the world of animals. Which had given her some comfort in a very difficult childhood, actually. She loved her pets as being the safe, you know, the safe sort of therapeutic haven. So everybody's experience is unique. Every family's different. Every parent's different. But to actually have to, and as a parent myself, I would not cope seeing something like this happening. You know, if there's an explanation and we know what it is and it's being ignored, covered up, still being visited on other people who are now at risk of God knows what in the future, what else are we to do? We have to stand up and scream and shout and get attention and make it stop by any and every means possible.
I hope you're aware of the gravitas and the authority that you bring into this battle by your voice speaking out so stridently, so strongly, so courageously, but honestly is the word that comes to mind.
Well, if it's within my power, it'll be sooner rather than later, you know. But we're all on the battle lines together. We just need a lot more people to come and join us and to not sit about waiting for somebody else to fix it. We've all got to fix it.
I tell you what I'm struck by, and I would be, wouldn't I, because that's my work. But I'm struck by your mother wanted to do medicine, but her father encouraged her to play music. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I mean, girls didn't do science. I mean, she came of age after the war. And girls didn't do science, certainly not in the, you know, where she came from. But she was always fascinated, and it would pee me off no end that I'd bring textbooks home to work from in university holidays, and she'd read something and seem to pick it up and remember it and understand it far more avidly than I could.
What did her father do?
He'd been in the Navy in World War One, and he was an engineer, very talented bloke, I think, but he actually shot himself at a fairly young age. I mean, my poor mum had a very traumatic childhood. You know, all of the terrible things that can happen to somebody happened to her in her first sort of couple of decades. And she reflected that. She was a very colourful person, but, you know, approached relationships with all her defences, full colour, full noise, as it were. But, you know, I've got a lot to be grateful to her for. And she certainly had a very jaundiced and sort of cynical and accurate view, actually, of humanity as a whole. And a lot of the things that I heard her say when I was growing up, that I rejected because, you know, you have a sort of a rosy view, I think, or you want to develop a kind of rosy, optimistic picture of life if you can. So I you know, rejected out of hand some of the more sort of negative stuff about human nature and humanity. But actually, she was spot on about a lot of it. And luckily, I managed to, you know, agree with her on a lot of this stuff before she died, which was a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Wow. So I'm just thinking about, you know, your grandfather in the First World War, then committing suicide, presumably, I'm assuming, because of the trauma of what he went through. Is that, would I be accurate in saying that?
I don't know, but certainly the family that my mother grew up in was pretty dysfunctional, you know, and her mother was a piece of work, as far as I can understand. I didn't know either of them. And she had a younger brother who died mysteriously in a car crash. And the wonder was at the time that that might have been suicide too. So, you know, a lot of kind of inherited pathology down that line. And so, you know, for all that, she was certainly a survivor. You know, she just grabbed life by the throat. And
I was going to say, she sounds like a real survivor. It's interesting, isn't it, that she developed migraines around concert playing, which sounds like she was good enough to be a concert musician.
She was. But she was, actually. She went on the pill, which when it first came out in the early 60s was pretty high dose. It had much higher estrogen doses. And the thought was probably in a, you know, genetically vulnerable person, that was the explanation. But, you know, I always wondered how much also of the psyche was involved there. Because she only really had pain, you know, well, I say only really had pain. I mean, it was severe pain. And certainly I've spoken to migraine sufferers who would happily blow their brains out. You know, and I've had two in my life, only two, thank God. And it's hard to believe you can have so much pain without there being something really terribly wrong going on in your head. And interestingly, both of those were just after periods of quite high stress had passed. Thankfully, I've never got into a pattern of having them regularly. And I wouldn't wish them on anybody.
So there we have the doctor talking about estrogen levels. And here we have the psychotherapist going, yeah, but maybe she didn't want to be a concert pianist.
Yeah, I think she'd have probably given it up fairly quickly. And in fact, she did play professionally, but she did the second instrument at music college, the bassoon, which she absolutely fell in love with. And so she did some gigging around London with that. You know, and yes, I can see you shaking your head. You know, very difficult instrument.
Wow.
To master.
And so beautiful. So beautiful. What a sound. The bassoon is just the most mellow, fruity. Oh, what a sound.
I think of all the instruments that can be made to sound, you know, easy and amazing, the work that goes into actually producing and keeping that sound is absolutely amazing. So her skill actually was teaching. She was very theatrical and she had, you know, inspired huge loyalty from the students and you know, some of them went on to do really, really great things. And she just loved performing. She was a sort of born performer, so she channeled that into her teaching.
And she was always interested in medicine, and you ended up doing medicine, where it sounds like what you really love is playing in the orchestra.
Yeah, look, that's partly true. I mean, I did wonder why the hell I'd done it. Well, I knew going in that probably it didn't feel like it was a passion, but I was very lucky, so I'd give it a go, and that I would use it to be able to travel. And after I graduated, it was fairly easy to, you know, take your degree and go and work in other places. So I worked in Ireland and France and Australia and I came here as well. But it wasn't until about halfway through my career, I suppose, when I started learning nutrition and environmental medicine, that suddenly all these pieces of the jigsaw sort of slotted home, and I suddenly started to understand why I'd never really been that into it. I mean, I love my anesthetics, but it was more important to me that I came and stayed in New Zealand than to see that all the way through. And I never really knew why that was at the time. It just felt it was my place, and I felt at home. But suddenly understanding, you know, having the tools and the, you know, the learning the principles of basic nutritional biochemistry and understanding how all the various kind of toxins floating around, you know, heavy metals and pesticides and all these other things actually derail, you know, bugger up your cellular metabolism, causing disease, was an absolute revelation to me. And I suddenly understood that this was my probably direction going in the future. So I learned as much as I could, and I ended up teaching for probably 12 years at a sort of postgraduate level, sort of fellowship level for a college in Australia. I loved that teaching too, because seeing lights go on and hearing over and over again, you know, doctors and other hallowed health professionals as well saying, why weren't we taught this right at the beginning? It makes so much sense. And again, there's that sort of evolutionary journey. And so often, the doctors especially, you know, talking would say, look, I've been thinking about doing this for 6, 8, 10 years, and I wish I'd done it before. You know, I've known there were things missing, or I've known that this would make me a better doctor. And often it would be people's own health journeys that started them off. Or they'd say, you know, my patients have been telling me I need to go and learn about diet and nutrition. So that was a tribe that I found as well. Doctors, again, who recognized the limitations of their early training and the possibilities from learning a bunch of other stuff, you know, it's far more likely to help you understand the cause of disease and help to put things right. And you can't unlearn things that you've learned. You know, there are some things you can't unsee and insights that you can't dump. You know, I would say to the medical council or the tribunal next year or whoever else criticizes me for the way that I think, it's not just a matter of choosing to think differently. I'm stuck with how I think and how I see things. And so are many of my colleagues. And there are people, you know, really great doctors and fabulous human beings who've already been put through the tribunal, you know, this kind of star chamber kangaroo court, where they're not presenting any evidence that these people have done any harm. And they're certainly not presenting any evidence to support why we're supposed to be wrong about the science. And they're ignoring the evidence that we produce. And yet we do it all again, over and over, because it's just, you know, we've become who we are through our own journeys. And we can't become different people.
I have heard so many times on this program, people saying, I really haven't got a great deal of choice. Mm. I've come to a point where choice is really the choice between truth and lies. I can either lie to myself, or I can follow my gut feeling and my knowledge and my head, my heart, and my gut. You put those three together. You put the thinking, you put the feeling, and you put the gut sense of rightness. And when you connect those three things, there's not much choice. There's only, I am now here, and this is all I can do. Here I stand.
So beautifully put. So people say often, oh, it must be very difficult. And yeah, the practical reality of not being able to, earn a living, not having a business to sell, sure. But, you know, I have no choice. It is almost, you know, it is beyond my control. The wind is in the sails and it's pushing me in this direction. I'm almost not in charge of it. There's something else happening, and there needs to be. I've certainly heard other people say the same thing. And because there are so many of us, though, and you touch beautifully on the congruency between the head, the heart, and the gut, we're no longer wandering around trying to make sense of what must be going on or what might be going on, because we can see it clear as day. The patterns are there, the consistent pattern of criminal behavior, malfeasance that we see in the pharmaceutical industry, that it's just a matter of public record. You know, this isn't conspiracy theory. It's all written down in black and white. You know, the size of the fines, how often they fine, the sort of things they're found guilty of, that kind of corporate psychopathy. But suddenly none of that matters, supposedly. And if we bring it up now, we're being told, you know, we're making it up, or it's all conspiracy theory. And yet when you know that there are black and white, rock solid facts that you can take to the bank, and that's probably not a good analogy, you know, you're presented with a different reality and you're supposed to swallow it. And you just can't. It's physically impossible. You know, and I guess that's the thing I find the most difficult. really of all of the elements of this is living, seeming to live in a kind of a parallel universe that we're all in. And yet the way we, you know, what we know, the way we experience what's happening is so incredibly different from what it feels like the majority of people believe and are all gathered around. There's this sort of, you know, clown world collusion going on. And we feel like we're on our own with this precious secret. It could be a matter of life and death for other people. And in fact, it is, and it has been, and it will continue to be. It's a kind of a gift and a poison chalice at the same time.
It certainly is. And just in case you're wondering what on earth you're listening to me, Jerry Pives, talk with Dr. Matt Shelton on real people in the psychotherapist chair. And this is RCR. And this is a really exciting and interesting conversation, which sadly, I'm going to have to draw to a close. I don't know how to draw this to a close, Matt, because we have touched on so many rich and important veins that I'd like to mine for more gold. You know, I'm down in Otago. You know, I went out yesterday and we were standing in the entrance to an old gold mine. And I'd love to mine this conversation for another couple of weeks, actually. I think there's enough here to keep us going for a very long time because I'm curious. But, you know, a couple of things I want to say. I want to say those people who are going to stand in judgment, those medical boards, you know, they're going to have to watch out, aren't they? Because history's going to judge them. History's going to judge them. And I wouldn't like to be on that side of history at any point. I wouldn't like to carry the burden of what I and future generations might need to carry. That those people are part of something that is very, very ugly. And history's going to judge them. And, you know, people are coming off these boards. I don't know if you've noticed this, but people are resigning from school boards. People are resigning from councils. People are resigning from psychotherapy boards and medical boards. The psychotherapy board is the same. You know, they told me I couldn't see patients, I couldn't see clients because I wouldn't take an injection. But anyone who did take an injection could see them. So my practice, my career was halted. It wasn't stopped like yours has been. But I was allowed again because I don't work in a medical environment. So that's okay, apparently. Apparently, they're different if you work privately than if you work in a medical situation. The air is different. Apparently, viruses carry in one place, but not in another.
That's right. Of course they do. Of course they do, Jerry. That's right. But look, you touched on something that's a fantastic example of how being intelligent, being educated, supposedly, is no defense against having your mind invaded. And that is that the psychotherapy board, the psychology board, didn't seem to be able to see what was happening. And they imposed the same nonsensical and judgmental discriminatory policies on their own members in order to, you know, to go along, to get along, because that's what many people will do. And if they couldn't see it, God help the rest of us. But there are people who have taken the money and taken the position and the power and the authority on some of these boards, who, as you say, people will be looking back to this period now and discussing it. Because, you know, I think this is the biggest story in humanity's history, or one of the biggest.
Well, what does history say about the bloody doctors in the World War II who gave all the names and descent of their clients who had Jewish origins to the Nazi administration? I'm thinking about France particularly is where I heard the history of it. You know, they were then rounded up. They were then killed. Doctors, it's not a proud profession.
No, it's not. And you could say they're very quick to throw their hat in with the winning side because they're smart, or because they understand human nature and maybe the inevitability of what's coming and they can't do anything about it. Or also they just get the power of an echo chamber and the importance of the group maintaining its kind of cohesion and all singing from the same hymn book. I don't know, but we've got a lot of damage to repair and there's a lot of fighting yet to be done. And certainly as long as there's breath in my body, and I know a lot of my colleagues feel the same thing, you know, it's a fight worth fighting. Of course it is. You know, we've got families, we've got kids, we've got a future planet that we've got to leave in better shape than we found it, and certainly than it is now.
What did you do in the war, Daddy? What war? You mean you didn't even know there was a war, Daddy? What were you doing? I had my head in the ground, or I had my hands over my ears, my eyes shut. I was going.
That's right. And it's just the child that spilt the milk, you know, and they put their fingers over their eyes. And if I don't see it, it hasn't happened. You know, and my great friend, Manny Garcia, who you may know, I mean, he's a Freudian psychoanalyst going way back. And I think he's onto something when he says we've all been reduced to a state of kind of magical thinking, a kind of a childlike state, because if you dismantle basic truths, like there are two biological genders, then, you know, these pillars that people use to decide, yeah, that they're sane and what's real and what isn't. And if you undermine those, people are taken back to this sort of much more childish state where anything's possible and it's a land of imagination and everything's wonderful and full of fairies and you'll believe anything. And I think that's been a deliberate strategy.
Psychologically, actually, I go back to fairy tales, all right? And you'll like this, I think. I think you'll like this. I think fairy tales are the repository of immense wisdom. They're the kind of the working man's and the working woman's Greek myth, which are quite complicated and hard to understand, I think. But the fairy tale straight ahead. And when you talk about delusional, fantasy, magical thinking, we have a fairy tale for that. And that's The Emperor's New Clothes. Mm. And who was it who broke the spell? Who was it who broke the insanity of the Emperor's clothing being not there at all? A child saying...
Yep.
The child shouts out in the crowd, you know, he's got no clothes on. So in some ways, I think that's what we're doing, isn't it? We're shouting out, the emperor's got no clothes on.
Absolutely we are. That's right. The emperor and the elephant, you know, very overused, but both very pithy and appropriate, of course, what's going on.
Yeah, the elephant in the room, right? Mm-hmm. There's a very bad smell here. I don't know what it can be. Well, you've got an elephant in the room. There's a lot of elephant dung being produced, and that's why there's a bad smell.
Yeah, let some air in and some light in. Muck it out.
Well, Matt Shelton, thank you so much for spending time in the psychotherapist chair with me, Jerry Pives. I have to say, it's been a blast. In fact, what I'm taking from our time together, apart from even more respect for you and your thinking and your journey and your search for truth and your curiosity, I'm going to take more than a blast. I'm going to say, do you know, if you want to get through tough times, you know, just blow a horn and get with other people to blow a horn and get with your mates and buddies. Find your tribe. Find your whanau. Find your group of people that can confirm your heroic and courageous stance. Forget confirmation bias. In this one instance, I say ignore the theory of confirmation bias. It's a good theory, but we need to confirm ourselves with fellow warriors who are fighting this battle with us. Meet with people and get with people. And I don't care if it's playing Strauss. I don't care if it's blowing a horn in the middle of a committee or singing in a choir where everyone's blowing air out. Discharge the trauma, get with people, get in community, get with people that are actually for truth, get with people that are putting themselves out for other people. Those are the people to hang out with. And if you do that and you blow your horn, you're probably going to make it. What do you think?
I love it. Love it, Jerry. Absolutely. So we could get a freedom orchestra. But, you know, so many of the creative pursuits actually come from crafts and how you spend your time. You know, getting by in a group, and these goddamn computers and smartphones and, you know, all the gadgets have taken us right away from that, I think, because we don't actually have to be shoulder to shoulder with, you know, other human beings if we don't want to be. And I think that's what we're going to get back to. And I think if we all did that, you know, the truths would emerge and that we will have so much more in common.
Well, Dr. Matt Shelton, thank you for all that you do. Thank you for talking with me. Thank you for humoring me. Thank you for sharing with the listeners bits of your life, beautiful bits of your life. I shall not forget any of what you shared with me. And above all, thank you for what you do and for the courageous battle that you are engaged in. And I just want to encourage you to keep looking after yourself, introvert or extrovert, doesn't matter. Do what works, you know, and you know what works for you. You're wise enough and old enough, I think, to know what works for you. And I just want to say on behalf of many, many listeners, God bless you and thank you for all that you do for us.
Oh, well, thank you, Jerry. And I actually enjoyed talking to you. It wasn't quite as horrendous as I thought the experience might be listening to myself. But thanks again.
Well, I'm looking forward to coming back in a bit and talking about some great pieces of music that touch you and that have meaning for you. So I'm looking forward to that.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.